David Brown is a history professor at Elizabethtown College and the author of Paradise Lost, A Life of F. Scott Fitzgerald. This is David Brown. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. Okay, great. I am here with David Brown. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's good to be with you.
So first off, you wrote a biography of F. Scott Fitzgerald called Paradise Lost. Why that title?
Well, the title is suggestive because it evokes the title of Fitzgerald's first novel, when he was a young man. And also, when I thought broadly about Fitzgerald's life and what he thought of America and where he thought America had been and where he somewhat pessimistically thought America was going, this notion of the Paradise Lost, that is the older America, the America that he obviously and somewhat romantically thought of in regard to his father, a kind of, you know, an antebellum fixture in his imagination. Fitzgerald, he was somewhat sorry to see that America go. He looked upon industrialization, he looked upon atomism, centralization, as things that you know, sort of precluded romance, precluded imagination and originality. And so, in some sense, you know, and this is ironic because we think of Fitzgerald as the quintessential jazz age writer, in a sense, he was sort of writing against the time. And so he did not think that he was living in the best of all possible worlds, you know, paradise on earth. He thought that perhaps the good times had passed him by. And I wanted to sort of bring that out in the title.
And I wanted to ask, when you say antebellum figure of his father, what exactly do you mean by that?
Sure. His father grew up in Maryland, and his father was born in the 1850s, and his father was a woeful capitalist, just couldn't really make money. The money was on the Fitzgerald side, or rather I shouldn't say it was on the McQuillan side, it was on his mother's side. And his father took some subtle pride in not being a good capitalist, because that was sort of the modern world, and that was a world that's you know, he didn't have the greatest respect for, and I think that he somewhat communicated that to his son. And so, you know, his father would have these tales about growing up in Civil War Maryland and seeing the Confederacy. And so for Fitzgerald, he sort of imbibed this. And so for Scott Fitzgerald, the Civil War, it wasn't so much about race or about slavery as we might think about it today, but it was about the notion of Johnny Reb, outnumbered, outgunned, but being able to hold his own, to be able to put off the might of Grant, of sheer numbers and of industry. And he sort of carried that worldview, Fitzgerald did, into other aspects of his life. So, for example, when it came time to pick a school, Princeton was known as the Southern School. Harvard and Yale took a lot of its students from northern prep schools, particularly New England prep schools. Princeton took quite a few from the South, had a pedigree. James Madison had gone to Princeton. And when Fitzgerald thought about football, college football, which he dearly loved, he always thought of Yale as winning just because it had the biggest players, whereas Princeton had more style, more elan. So obviously this is something of an imagined past that he projects upon his father. His father, you know, sort of contributes to that as well, gives him these stories, weans him on these stories, and then it becomes part of Fitzgerald's, I think, emotional and imaginative apparatus. He's a smart man. He knows that not all of this stuff is real, but also I think that it fuels his creativity.
So, I mean, that's a little disappointing, to say the least, that he had that sort of affection for the Confederacy or the antebellum South. And you talk about, you know, at the end of Gatsby, where he's you know, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. Do you think that's part of this obsession with reclaiming the past?
It's a good question. You can see elements of the Southern imagined past in some of the work. In one of the stories, he has romantic lead named Henry Clay Marston. And he's referencing Henry Clay, the old Kentucky senator who had slaves. But for Fitzgerald was sort of a good Southerner because he was a compromiser. Fitzgerald would have, when he learned his American history, he would have learned that Henry Clay, the Compromise of 1850, the Compromise of 1820. Fitzgerald's concerns, he was born in the 1890s, and as you know, he was writing predominantly in the 1920s, 1930s. And you look at where American culture was at that point in time. Gone with the Wind was a major book before it became a major movie. And, you know, it said that the winners don't write the history. But in certain respects, the Lost Cause myth of the American South, it was very predominant in the culture. And so Fitzgerald would in no sense have been unique in adopting unreflectively, perhaps unthinkingly, romantically, some of those cues and gestures. The Great Gatsby, there's sort of, some overtones of it there. There's the desire for aristocracy. Certainly, Jay Gatz is from the North. But his friend and narrator in the novel, who's also from the North, but he's from the hardware company. His family in the hardware business. And Fitzgerald was saying the hardware business was this good, authentic American business. And it's the people with the money, the new money, like Buchanan's. Those are the people you have to really, look out for because they're dangerous, or as he puts in the novel, they're careless. So whereas someone like Nick Carraway from the hardware business, who's a friend of Gatsby's, he's in something foundation, hardware, mom and pop, earnest, hardworking, and not money-centric. And so there's a variation there. Nick isn't a Southerner, but he is engaged in what Fitzgerald would see as a, quote-unquote, traditional business, whether the business is, having a farm or having a hardware company. And in the 1880s and 1890s, populism was a major response to industrialization and financed capitalism in America. In fact, it ran presidential candidates, and it actually won the legislatures of about a dozen states in the American Midwest, in the Plain States. So it was quite strong. It was quite proficient. And to a certain extent, there is that romantic sensibility in the agrarian attitudes. It was not Fitzgerald's first reflex, though. Those would have been very poor farmers. And as we know from Fitzgerald, he was a little bit attentive to and enraptured by, perhaps too enraptured by, the people who had money. And so for him, an agrarian, an idolized agrarian, a romantic agrarian, would be someone more along the lines of Thomas Jefferson, who had a lot of land. He was a statesman. He had leisure. He was an intellectual. And, of course, we would emphasize today, he held slaves. And that came off of his largess, his education. So much came off of the backs of three generations of slaves. But for Fitzgerald and for most people, I think, of his generation, clearly they would not have seen it the same way.
Oh, yeah, they didn't care at all about that.
That's right.
So I'm curious, when he gets to Princeton, okay, and there's something in there, because I want to ask about how and why he became a writer. And I remember at one point in my school library picking up, it was something like F. Scott Fitzgerald's diary when he was in elementary school. And even at that early age, he's talking about the girls in his class and, how to win them over romantically and, dressing foppishly and slicking his hair and all these kinds of things. And those two, that character trait of trying to, be a man about town and also injecting it into his writing seemed to start at an early age. Why exactly, if we can answer this, did he become a writer?
Oh, that's a tough one, isn't it? He becomes a writer young, and he's very interested in the writing process, and he's very, very interested in how the imagination works. And I think that some of that is tied to his sense of history and his romantic sense his father's past, in a somewhat embarrassed sense of his mother's McQuillan past. Again, that was the merchant past. That was the Irish immigrant past that he didn't really want to pay too much attention to. But he was sensitive to it. And I think that he was very much interested in the workings of America, the social classes, the money. And, you know, he's doing this apprentice work when he's 13, when he's 15, when he's 18. His first novel comes out when he's still in his early 20s. And so at his private academy at Hackensack, New Jersey, at Princeton, he's writing all kinds of things, reviews, stories, plays, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He never got his degree from Princeton. He was there for 4 years, but he really wasn't there to get a degree in English or chemistry. He was there to absorb the high bourgeoisie, to look at this sort of cultural moment, modernism, and to do it from the center, that is from the East Coast, not so much the circumference, not from St. Paul, where he had done much of his growing up. And so he was always being sensitive about this, and he was always looking to see how things worked, and he was always putting it down on paper. And so by the time it comes about, you know, for him to truly be serious and try to write a novel, this wasn't something unique or unusual. In fact, so much of what he put in that novel, sometimes verbatim, he took from his earlier work. That's why The Side of Paradise, the first novel, is a bit of a mishmash. Because he's got writings from 2 years ago, from 4 years ago. Some of it's edited and refined, some not so much. But he was always thinking about what was happening with the country. He was always looking for ways to tell that story in interesting, provocative ways that appealed to him, that he knew would appeal to a reading audience. Fitzgerald, he said in life, late in life, well, he didn't live that long. He died in his early 40s, but he once said that his parents, and in particular the fact that there was this sadness in the family because he had two older sisters who died when they were very young. He never even knew them. But that sort of overshadowed a lot of, I think, his early memories as a child. And so to be in that atmosphere, and to pick up that there's this big thing out there that has an impact on your parents, on the family life, but you don't know what it is because they won't talk about it. That gave him this suggestion, this hint, that there were things out there that had a tremendous impact on our lives, but we weren't allowed to talk about them. But he wanted to talk about them. And he claimed that's what really began to put him on the course for being a writer.
See, now that's interesting because I talked to a biographer of Van Gogh for this podcast before, and he had a similar circumstance where he was not the first Vincent Van Gogh. He had an older brother who died during childbirth, and that's, I don't know what to make of that. That's just something I kind of noted as you were saying that. But you mentioned he died young, so can we say for sure that he was an alcoholic?
He was an alcoholic. He wasn't specifically diagnosed, but he was. He obviously knew that he had some real problems with the bottle. Like a lot of people in the 1930s, he attributed it to a moral failing, not thinking that he suffered from any type of a disease. He was counseled from time to time, because his wife was receiving a treatment from psychiatrists, that perhaps he should seek some treatment as well, and he was resistant to that. He thought that this could mess with his creative process, that writing for him was a bit of a trick, and so if being quote unquote fixed meant that he would be, you know, sort of sober, that he would lose that creativity, he didn't really want any part of it. He put the arts, his writing, in front of his health, and he doubled down on it by sort of in a punishing way, attributing his drinking more to a moral failure on his part than on what we would see today as a disease. So again, here's an example of Fitzgerald being very much, you know, a man of his time and a man of his culture.
Yeah, but don't you feel like that's kind of a mistake that a lot of artists make, where they think that, you know, oh, if I go through life and if I get better? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, you mentioned Hemingway earlier, and it makes me think of you know, several of the great writers of that time, including William Faulkner, who had battles with the bottle. The thing with Fitzgerald is his was so public because he kind of put it out there in the writing, and he thought that was being true to his art. Fitzgerald was an alcoholic, but that wasn't so widely known at the time. And so for Fitzgerald, or rather for Hemingway, sort of keeping his identity, keeping his reputation as the quote-unquote pure artist, that was the main thing. And unfortunately, his relationship with Fitzgerald kind of slipped into this stream whereby they would play these, you know, kind of roles where Fitzgerald would be, I think, a little bit subservient to Hemingway as the monastic artist, even though Hemingway was a drinker as well. And Fitzgerald would genuflect a little bit too much in that direction. And Hemingway would sort of then, you know, regard Fitzgerald as this, you know, sort of, you know, unfortunate drunkard who obviously has these great skills, but he blunts his own sword with the drinking. And you could see this coming out in some of the letters. We have published editions of Fitzgerald's letters with his editor, Max Perkins at Scribner, and Hemingway also wrote for Scribner on Fitzgerald's suggestion before Hemingway became this major writer in the early 1920s. And so we also have, in published form, Hemingway's letters to Max Perkins, and among other topics, the conversation, the subject of drinking does come up.
Yeah, and what was the deal where Hemingway apparently blamed Zelda for his drinking, you know, said that she's wasting his talent or something like that? Was there any truth there, or was that kind of Hemingway, you know, blaming the woman, I guess?
Well, Zelda's perspective is that she had seen through Hemingway, that she knew that all this macho stuff was a bit of a pose. And this was really part of Hemingway's identity, how he liked to see himself. And so in revenge, the story goes, he attacks Zelda. And so in a manuscript that will be published not long after Hemingway's death, in early 1960s, A Movable Feast, he's got a chapter in there where the story that you just sort of walked us through there, where he thinks that Zelda has kind of eaten away at her husband's creativity. That's where most of that comes from. I tend to be somewhat more favorable with Zelda in this conflict between the two. She was not overly impressed with Hemingway. That's okay. That's fine. She thought that she didn't like the way that her husband reacted with Hemingway, and that was fine too. I think she had reason. And
You said he didn't like the way he interacted with Hemingway. How do you mean?
Yeah, she thought that that her husband was an artist, and that by the time that he began to, you know, sort of promote Hemingway, Fitzgerald was just finishing up his third novel, The Great Gatsby, and Hemingway hadn't published a novel yet. Zelda thought that her husband was, you know, kind of too taken with Hemingway, who, to her mind, was putting on this pose as the American abroad. Hemingway was also in Paris, and he was living behind, apparently, a sawmill because the rent was so cheap, and he was just living hand-to-mouth, although he had a young family with him at the time, and was putting everything into his art. And, this notion of Fitzgerald being sort of a playboy, kind of an avatar of the jazz age, it slights his artistic sensibility and some of the real strong and serious work that he did. And actually, you know, I think Zelda, early in their marital life, I think she was protective of that. And I think that she saw Hemingway as someone who was going to demand to be the artist, you know, the only artist, or at least the best artist in the room. And I think that she might have intuited that this is someone who wasn't going to have a healthy relationship with her husband. And and Fitzgerald's relationship with Hemingway was, you know, problematic. And in many respects, I think Zelda was right. And Hemingway, who I don't think necessarily always knows what to do with strong women, what he did with Zelda was he attacked her, and he, you know, in some respects, blamed her for her husband's alcoholism.
I'm sure you're familiar with this, but there's a passage from A Movable Feast where Hemingway talks about, it's probably some made-up story, but Fitzgerald, when they were living in Paris, comes to him with some problem where, you know, he can't satisfy his wife in the bedroom, and so Hemingway has to, you know, teach him some sort of manly tricks about how to go about doing that. And clearly, Hemingway looks at him as the inferior in the relationship, or looked back on him as being the inferior in the relationship. At what point did the power balance shift in that relationship from Hemingway being mentored to becoming the dominant force there?
Well, certainly by the end of Fitzgerald's life, because Hemingway had published a work on the Spanish Civil War, From the Bell Tolls, in 1940. And this was a big, big seller. So it wasn't simply that you know, Hemingway had published The Sun Also Rises, The Farewell to Arms, and it was recognized as an artist in his own right. But by 1940, he was also recognized as being a popular writer as well. And that's something that Fitzgerald had coveted, because to be in that category, to write work that is embraced by a reading public, but you can still keep your reputation as an artist, it means that, well, for Fitzgerald, it would mean that he would not have to write so many short stories. It would mean that he would have financial security. So I think, at least in a financial sense, you know, by the late 1930s, 1940, Hemingway is in a very enviable position. As an artist, you know, that depends on I guess who you are and what you like. You know, one could say that you know, by 1934, Fitzgerald had written three enduring novels: The Great Gatsby, Tender as the Night, and The Side of Paradise. And he'd also written, you know, a body of short stories that pretty much, you know, sealed his reputation, or should have, as an artist. But there was insecurity there on his part, and he had a difficult time sometimes seeing himself as a serious artist for a number of reasons, including the drinking and some of his behavior that went along with that. So, you know, I think what I've sort of discovered over the years, you probably have as well, is that there are Fitzgerald people and there are Hemingway people. I like both. But Fitzgerald, he speaks to me in a way, probably because of my own background and experiences, in ways that Hemingway doesn't. But I've talked with people who prefer Hemingway, and they'll tell me some things about their own life and how it intersects, or they think it intersects, with material that Hemingway is getting at, including aspects of mental illness that speak to them. And so, you know, it's that great question when you're talking about, you know, two artists, two presidents, two athletes, who had the better career, who was the greatest, how do we rank these people? And I think it depends upon not just the artists, but the judges themselves.
Yeah, I mean, ranking artists is so subjective. You know, I think there's room enough for both these characters, or both these writers, and more. But one of the things you said there that I wanted to touch on was the fact that F. Scott Fitzgerald, of all people, could not see himself as a serious artist, or struggled to see himself that way. And you know, that must have just torn him apart, where he writes a book like The Great Gatsby, where I would imagine if you're capable of writing a book that good, you would also have to be a pretty good judge of what, you know, constitutes good literature. So on some level, he probably had to have known, okay, this is first-rate stuff. But then on the other hand, when critically and commercially it flops, he must have had some voice in his head saying, like, okay, am I just delusional here? What effect did that have on him psychologically?
It was a great disappointment to him that that The Great Gatsby did not prove to be a large seller. Because that was the book that he thought artistically had a real opportunity to connect with a large readership. And I referenced his editor, Max Perkins, earlier. And Perkins wrote to him, this is probably about 2 weeks after the book is out, because you know by then, you just know. And he said, you know, this isn't going to be a big seller. It's not going to be what we wanted it to be. And that was difficult for Fitzgerald. It meant that he would have to, you know, get back on the circuit and write a lot more short stories. He once said, I think this was to his editor as well, that he wanted to be forced upon readers, like Joseph Conrad was forced upon readers, meaning that even if the popular audience didn't always sort of get what Conrad was up to, the fact that he was, you know, Joseph Conrad, and that he was in the canon, that people would just, you know, they would buy the books, and they would read the books or not read the books, but he would be part of the conversation. The irony, of course, is that Fitzgerald, he died young. He was in his early 40s. And had he lived even a decade, maybe 2 decades longer, he would have seen this Fitzgerald revival, and he would have seen The Great Gatsby take off in the 1960s, 1970s, like, of course, it did not take off in the 1920s. He was sensitive to book sales. He involved himself as much as he could in the marketing of the books. He would write to Max Perkins, and he would say, you know, I don't like this image on the cover. Why don't you try this image on the next book? Because he saw this as an opportunity for him to be taken seriously as a writer. So, yeah, we all have egos. And his ego, and also his pocketbook said, is there any way that I can be taken seriously, not just by artists, not just by literary people, but also by the reading public? Well, the great irony is that the book that sold the most during his lifetime, one of his books, was the first one, which was published when he was in his early 20s. And I believe it sold for like 50,000 copies, 55,000 copies the first year. And of course, you know, there wasn't Amazon.com. You weren't going to go online 2 years later and order a copy. You might have to go to a bookstore and order a copy and have it come in, you know, like a couple weeks later. People just didn't do it that way. You know, so the vast majority of the books that were going to be sold, you're going to sell them probably the first month or the first year. And so the message that he was being given was that if he can produce a work of art like The Great Gatsby or Tender as the Night, the public won't buy it in the way that they will buy something like a confection or a fable or this, you know, very interesting college story that was the first novel. So the culture in some way was saying, give us lighter stuff. And it's something that in some respects I think Fitzgerald, you know, kind of struggled with, because he very much wanted to be an artist first.
Why do you think the Fitzgerald phenomenon happened in the 60s and 70s? That seems kind of strange.
Yeah, I think in some respects, I think the culture kind of caught up with Greg Gatsby. First of all, let's be honest. It's a thin book. Like Faulkner's As I Lay Dying is a thin book. And so what I'm suggesting here is that you could assign it in college or high school, and it's not this, you know, Trollope, you know, or Dickens, 600-page. It's very concise. I think the themes, I think the mood that he conveys in The Great Gatsby, I think in some respects, I think they speak to a post-war sensibility and mood, perhaps even more so than the period that he was writing about. Because what he's writing about, in some sense, is the great takeoff of this dynamic economic engine and all the social and cultural change that comes with it. So what he sees occurring in the 19-teens and 1920s, it is still gaining speed and steam. And so I think by the post-war period, I think that some things that he's writing about are even more recognizable to people than they would have been perhaps in 19-teens and 20s. In some respects, I think that there were people, particularly parents, who might have looked at Fitzgerald in 1920s as someone who could explain certain things to them about why their daughter, for example, wants to bob her hair. In that sense, Fitzgerald, he was a little bit ahead of his time, and he was something of a cultural anthropologist telling these people, you know, here's the change that's happening, here's what's going on. But in the 1950s and 60s, we are deeper into this change, and I think Fitzgerald, he speaks to the climates of that time.
And so, again, you mentioned he died young, and near the end of his life, he wrote this book called The Crack Up. And basically, he goes through and details how the wheels came off. And he's basically looking at himself retrospectively as a finished writer and saying, you know, how I failed. And it's really, I don't want to use the word pathetic, but it's definitely sad. And go ahead.
I was just going to say that the crack up is, it can be hard sledding. It's a triptych. It's three articles that he had published in the 1930s. And ostensibly, he is reviewing his career lightly and viewing it through the prism of, you know, this quote-unquote failure that he now feels as being this kind of encompassing force in his life. And it's confessional writing at a time when artists, for the most part, didn't do confessional writing. You know, Sylvia Plath, Robert Lowell, they wouldn't come along until later. And it could be hard to read. It's not exactly honest. He acknowledges that he is a drinker, but he doesn't really go into any great depth about the degree of the problem. In fact, he sort of elides it. You know, people think that this is all about drinking. Well, of course it isn't. He attributes his difficulties in some sense to the culture, shifting cultural sensibilities. He attributes the difficulties to, in some cases, you know, just difficult luck, bad luck, you know, fate, the romantic way out. And so in that sense, you know, he promises us a candid review about, you know, this crack up, how he came to this point in his 30s where he just couldn't function like he used to. In some sense, it almost reads like a book of the Bible, because there's this notion of, you know, there I was at this height, and then, you know, came the pride and the hubris, and then there was the fall. And he took a lot of criticism for it. Hemingway hated it. He said, look, you know, you don't advertise this stuff. You sort of keep it to yourself. That's Hemingway, the Stoic, you know, you suffer in silence. Maxwell Perkins, his editor, thought that this triptych was Scott sort of searching for a new kind of creative outlet that, as he wrote in one private letter, Scott couldn't be feeling that bad, because that would be near suicidal. And for people who feel that bad, they never really talk about it. It's all internal. And so this is a very, you know, sort of like 1930s notion of these, you know, strong men who are around Fitzgerald who just aren't quite getting what he's going through. But then again, there's Fitzgerald who isn't quite candid about what he's going through himself. There's also the leitmotif of his blaming Zelda in some of these sentences in this triptych. And he doesn't, you know, sort of come out and say it, but it's there, you know, if you read between the lines. And so, in a sense, he's revising something that appears quite often, you know, in the short stories and sometimes, obviously, in the novels like The Great Gatsby, and that is the young man, the young artist, who had tried to reach a great height and to some extent was weakened or even taken down by the love of a woman. And so there's some good cultural commentary in this triptych. I've used it in you know, a couple of my classes before. But when it strays into the self-pitying, it becomes a little bit unpalatable.
Well, you mentioned what Max Perkins said. Oh, he couldn't have felt that bad. I imagine he felt pretty awful. I mean, by the end of his life, did he see himself as a failure?
I think that's, you know, it's a good question. And by nature, it's a hard question. And when we talk about failure, what do we mean? Maybe the most famous literary failure was Henry Adams, who came from that famous family. And he wrote The Education of Henry Adams in 1907, and he said that his life was a failure. But he was being very ironic about this, because what he really meant was that in an America where capitalism begins to take over, and where people like John Adams or George Washington or John Quincy Adams, when they're no longer wanted, then that civilization is a failure. So he was ironically explaining his inability and the inability of his brothers to gain political office by saying that, well, our education was a failure, but really it was the culture. I mention Henry Adams because I think it fits Gerald in some respects in a similar sense, because from time to time he would refer to himself as a failure. I'm not sure if he ever actually specifically used that word, but he would sort of play down to that. But I think in some respects, not unlike Adams, he was making some cultural commentary that if this is a kind of culture where a Great Gatsby or where a Tender of the Night isn't being recognized or respected, then you know, is that so much me or is that the culture? As I mentioned before with the crack-up, there was a self-pitying side to Fitzgerald. And it was not an attractive side, and when he drank, that would only be embellished. That side of him would only be embellished, and so we have a lot of his letters. And anybody can read this stuff. They're at Princeton, but you have to go to Princeton. There are print editions and collections, and as the years go by, and his book sales decrease, and as he finds it increasingly, I think, difficult to negotiate or accept certain things, certain changes in the environment around him, he becomes increasingly pessimistic. And this comes out in a number of ways. When he's in Los Angeles, he still dresses like he is a prep student on the East Coast. He makes no concessions to the California weather. He'll wear his Homburg hat. He'll wear his heavy coat. It's an interesting side of Fitzgerald because we think of him as being so dynamic and so fluid. But as I mentioned with his title, Paradise Lost, he was deeply invested in a kind of an imagined past, and he only gave it up reluctantly. So one might say, to really come to the point of your question, did he see himself as a failure? In some respects, he saw America as having bartered away, given away its better side. In that sense, the country was a bit of a failure. And as a romantic, he shared the fate of what he would see as the better side, the better sides, the better angels of that country. And so if Gatsby represents this great ideal of some sorts, what happens to Gatsby? Gatsby dies. Gatsby is a failure. And the redeeming narrative, or the narrator of that story, Mick Carraway, he will no longer stay in the New America, in the East. He'll leave the bond business, he'll leave finance, and he'll go back to the hardware business in the safe and settled Midwest. So Fitzgerald did have this notion of failure, but it was much, much bigger than his own.
Wow. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. It is, I have to say, a little narcissistic to claim that I didn't fail. You know, the country failed. But I guess, you know, he has a point there. I want to let you go, but the last question I wanted to ask you, when you mentioned how F. Scott Fitzgerald became sort of the voice of a generation, do you think that is still possible for a writer to do that? Or do you think that the medium of writing has passed to the wayside of, you know, it will no longer offer us anyone who could even be considered a voice of a generation?
Yeah, that's a strong question. I think a lot of this stuff is always media-driven, and it was in Fitzgerald's time as well. And then the question is, you know, does the artist want to play up to it? And Fitzgerald and Zelda, they were willing to play up to it. They were willing to, for a while there, be sort of Mr. and Mrs. Jazz Age. So I think that the media is always interested in, you know, the quote-unquote next great American novel. I'd like to believe that there are artists out there who, in a number of mediums, including literature, can capture moments very clearly and very strongly. And if they do that, that's enough. That's more than enough. And whatever the media determines to make of that, you know, so be it. That's the culture that we live in. That's the economy that we live in, and that's the structure of how I think art gets commodified. So for better or for worse, I think there's always going to be the desire to find the next great American poet or novelist. And one can only hope that whoever is anointed has enough strength to survive that.
All right, I think that's a good note to end it on. David, thanks so much for your time.
It's good to be with you, and I've enjoyed the conversation, of course.
All right, bye-bye now. All right, thank you to David Brown, and thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.